Hello, and welcome to 37th and the World, the official podcast of the Georgetown Journal of International Affairs. GIJIA is a student-run flagship publication of Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. On 37th and the World, we dive into key global trends and speak directly with the experts working on the issues in areas ranging from conflict and security, human rights and development, science and technology, society and culture, business and economics, and global governance.
Food insecurity is one of the most daunting global issues. Approximately 1 billion people are at risk of malnourishment across the world. In 2021, the New Global Commons Working Group at Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy, or ISD, put together Peace Through Food, Ending the Hunger and Instability Nexus, a report that synthesizes analyses of food scarcity and political instability in order to guide policymakers. In an interview with Kelly McFarland, Director of Programs and Research at the ISD, GIJIA discusses the gravity of this crisis and the implications of the working group's report for the leadership of nation states and international organizations.
In the recently published report, Peace Through Food, Ending the Hunger and Instability Nexus, the working group described the various explanations for worldwide food insecurity with deep concerns, ranging from food as a weapon of war and food waste, to climate change and global unequal food distribution. The COVID-19 pandemic worsened many of these conditions, but to what degree did COVID-19 undermine the global campaign to end hunger, most notably as one of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for 2030? Further, what were the most destructive elements of this pandemic pertaining to food security, and which regions felt the most significant impact?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, and glad to see you guys read the report and are taking away some of the key points from it. I think, you know, the COVID pandemic had a huge effect on global hunger and the fight to end global hunger and the sustainable development goals of the UN and all of that stuff. I think it undermined this in a number of ways. I mean, first of all, as you saw in the report, it had a huge effect just on expanding the number of people that are hungry and that are going hungry just because of the supply chain breakdowns, whether that is because of panic buying in some, you know, developed countries or rich countries like the U.S. I mean, we all saw increased lines of food banks and shelves without meat because of the closure of meat processing plants and things in the United States. But and it also affected this because, you know, people were out of work because of shutdowns and things like that. So it affected people's ability financially to purchase food as well. So not only did it expand the number of people going hungry, and that I think the numbers are in the report, but it expanded it by hundreds of millions. It did that, but it also, you know, and this is, you know, to be expected, but it also took people's focus away from hunger, because you're dealing with a global pandemic that we needed to get ahead of, if possible. You know, all efforts were put towards trying to figure out what to do with that, whether it be, should we do lockdowns, should we not, what type of lockdowns do we put in place? And then a lot of our efforts were put into, you know, creating testing regimes and getting tests and things that worked out to the public, and then getting vaccines and getting those shipped around and sent around the world. And we're still dealing with that. So I think, you know, this is something that's to be expected, but it did affect food and ending hunger in multiple ways.
Given the current inaction on addressing climate change, what obstacles will climate change bring about in the upcoming years and decades for food security? The ISD report touches upon, for example, locust swarms and extreme weather events. Is climate change already the most daunting challenge for food security currently?
Well, I mean, yes, I think it is. But you also have to keep in mind that there's multiple different, all of this is tied together, right? I mean, it's the food system and how it's not situated to deal with climate change very well. And it also exacerbates climate change. I mean, our current food system is like the third or fourth largest emitter of harmful gases and things that cause climate change. So it's all intertwined, so it's hard to separate out different issues on this. But I think, you know, climate change will have a massive effect on this, and we're seeing it, you know, all over the world, not just in one region or one country in particular. But, you know, you mentioned the locust swarms and more extreme weather events. You know, the locust swarms had serious effect on crops in Africa, and you have extreme weather events in all over the world that are getting worse, whether or not it's longer droughts or worsening storms. You know, climate change causes hurricanes now that we've seen especially in the southern United States in the past few years, that just sort of park themselves over places and move much more slowly. And they're also sucking up more water into the storms as well. So they're just kind of sitting over places and dumping rain in levels that we haven't seen before. And that obviously has effects on trying to grow crops. And you know, you have extremes of drought on one hand, in places like the Southwest United States is going through a decades-long drought right now, using up a lot of the water sources that they have. And at the same time, it's the fastest growing areas of the United States. So we're actually sending more people are moving to the places where we're running out of water and already experiencing a drought. And then on the flip side of that, then you have these massive storms that dump rain and you know, cause crops because there's too much water. You know, it affects things in multiple different ways, but climate change is going to have an effect on where you can grow things, what's being grown, and it's going to take if something's not done, it's going to cause a lot more harm before things sort of shake out and climates change in different areas of the world so you can grow crops in different places where you necessarily didn't before. That's going to be an ongoing issue and just getting worse, especially if we don't move quickly to not only address climate change, but address the food system and the way we create food and move food around the world and what types of food we're eating as well.
Thank you for that response. Moving on to another issue touched upon in the report, the migration crisis is one of the many consequences that have resulted from food insecurity. What responsibilities do states and international organizations have in mitigating this crisis?
Well, I think they have a huge responsibility. And I think, again, you know, this is all intertwined. It's climate change is causing a lot of the food insecurity, not necessarily all of it. You also have conflict and people can't get access to food because of conflict, so they migrate. But it's all intertwined. And we did a working group report on this as well back in 2016, talking about environmental security and human migration and how people are migrating more and more because of climate change and the inability to secure livelihoods or continue the livelihood that they've been used to. And a lot of that stems from or revolves around creating food or producing food. So that's a big issue and it's an ongoing issue. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, there's refugees because of political reasons, but the international community is still trying to figure out exactly how to deal with climate migrants or these migrants that are moving because of these other issues and how we view them and how we can take them into other areas. And I think, you know, the answer lies in a lot of different places. I mean, we need to understand that people are moving for these reasons and they're going to be moving in larger numbers in the future. And we have to figure out ways to deal with that, create new mechanisms to take those people in and deal with them. But also think of new ways to allow them to secure livelihoods without moving and doing different things if they can to try to stay where they are. But then also the climate change issues wrapped up in this too. We need to do more on climate change to get to the point where temperatures don't rise to a level that make things even worse so that we can try to cut down on the numbers of migrants moving for these reasons in the future. Now, a lot of this is already baked in, as you guys, I'm sure, are aware, because of, you know, the already heightening temperatures and increasing temperatures that aren't going to go away anytime soon and are going to continue to get worse. So the international community really needs to step up to find ways to to deal with this, whether or not it's through regional bodies that are created in these areas that we know. You know, for instance, the Sahel in Northern Africa, we know that the desert is getting bigger and there's already issues of folks moving and migrating in large numbers. The Middle East is going to get harder and harder to grow food, and it's going to get hotter and hotter. And there's other, you know, many places around the world like that. For one reason or another, it's going to be harder to sustain livelihoods and grow food. So the more we can do to think about that and wrap it into policies we're creating for the future, I think the better off we will be in not having these quote unquote crises in the future. You'll still have people migrating, but you'll have answers to it and ways to think about how to deal with that.
Thank you. Speaking of interconnected issues, food waste is also touched upon. How can global cooperation address the unequal relationship between countries that produce the most waste and countries that end up receiving it?
The countries that end up receiving what?
The waste, in terms of waste dumping.
So I'm not really sure. I mean, we didn't really delve into the waste dumping per se, but we did deal more with the issue of food waste in general and food loss also, which is a huge issue. And the loss part of it goes to, you know, the issue of shoring up our food supply chains. And that goes back to sort of rethinking and reforming the food system in general. And realizing that a lot of the food that we produce gets lost in transit for one reason or another. For instance, during the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of increased food loss in many ways because of lockdowns and not being able to cross borders or only being able to transport at certain times that affected food in many different ways. And one answer we had for that, and one suggestion we had for that, but it also gets to a lot of other issues as well as trying to fix those is trying to be more local in food production and food use and trying to source your food products more locally and not trying to get away from these huge supply chains. And the issue of food waste that I think gets to more of just, you know, creating more knowledge around the issue of food waste and getting that out there to the public. And a large part of this moving forward is going to be educating the public on the food system and the detrimental aspects of it. And food waste is a huge part. And all of us can work on that and think about, you know, the food that we're wasting on a daily basis. And I know it's hard, but I mean, after doing this working group and doing the research on this, just, you know, what I feed my kids on a daily basis and like how much I cook for them ahead of time, not wanting to make sure that there's not, you know, a bunch of things that I cooked that they didn't eat then and that are going to be leftovers or thrown away, and just trying to think about that before I cook things and make sure that I'm going to cook something they're going to eat instead of, but with, you know, with a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, that's oftentimes very difficult because they're picky eaters. But, you know, thinking about these things, I think it starts on a personal level, the food waste, and rethinking, you know, what we think of as something that's edible in many ways. I mean, how many times do you not eat an apple per se because it just doesn't look quite right? And that's all stuff that's been ingrained in us through marketing and different things and the big food producers over many, many years and decades, and things that we need to just sort of reframe how we look at food, I think, and it starts at a personal level.
Thank you for that. Moving on to another part of the report, the report also emphasizes the need to understand food security as a first order and global common right rather than a good that can be commodified. What states and organizations have adopted this first order framework into their work?
Well, I know that the UN and some of the international bodies are trying to view this in this fashion, but as far as like states go and things like that, it hasn't moved beyond the international bodies. And I know there's a lot of NGOs and and think tanks and academics and people that work on this that are trying to reframe it around that and refocus it in that way. But I think it really, if it's viewed in that aspect, I think it goes a long way to get at what we're trying to do in our main points in the report that talk about the idea that a lot of viewing food as a human right and as a global commons right gets goes a long way towards using food as a means to an ends for peace and ending conflict. Not only will you get to the, you know, help, will it help us get to the sustainable development goals and try to end hunger just because we should be, but it also has that, another byproduct of that is then enabling us to end many conflicts that are caused by or help to spur on hunger and food insecurity. And also it helps us to get out in front of potential future conflicts by taking food out of the equation and having it not be something that people, you know, join a militant group because they know that they can get food or money to buy food through them and things like that. So I think it goes a long way to stemming a lot of those issues.
Thank you. I remember that there's also an emphasis that humanitarian aid alone is not enough to address food insecurity. However, alongside structural change, how can humanitarian aid be used in tandem with that kind of change?
Well, I mean, humanitarian aid's not going away, obviously. And we don't, you know, we're not saying that it should or that it could in this paper. We're just saying, as you noted, that it's not enough, right? I mean, humanitarian aid, it serves a purpose and is needed and does a lot of really good things. And we need humanitarian aid to go into conflict areas, to provide aid to people that can't get food and resources. We need it after, you know, massive storms and things like that that destroy infrastructure and destroy crops and things so people can eat and get medicine and water and all that stuff. That's going to be needed in the future and it's not going to go away. But what we talk about it is that it doesn't, as you mentioned, it doesn't get at those structural issues that are causing the need for humanitarian aid in the first place. And that's where we need to work at changing the food systems overall so that, and using food to try to end conflict and create a situation where you're not jumping to conflict over food in the first place. And I think in those instances, humanitarian aid is always still going to be needed and will be used in tandem with these larger structural policies that can be put in place to try to fix the food systems and change the food systems in a way where we won't necessarily hopefully need as much humanitarian aid in the future.
Thank you. Our last main question is how the report lists a number of international organizations, government agencies, and NGOs that currently campaign against food insecurity, a great number of them, in fact. Does any single organization particularly stand out to you as an example for other groups to potentially model their strategies? Or would that be very difficult to implement as each region potentially faces food security within its own special context?
Well, I think it is important, and we note that in the working group report as well, that each country region is unique and each community within a country is unique. So we have to make sure that when implementing policies and changes to the structure of the system moving forward, that we need to take that into account. You can't necessarily take a top-down approach and plug something globally that's going to work everywhere. That doesn't work. And we need to think of this and structure all of these to a local or regional context that works best for that local region or that local region. And at times, we can try to take local fixes and policies and expand them out where they will work. But we have to take that individual context into account when we implement these policies and create new policies. That's extremely important. But as far as the one group or NGO or international body that's really working well on this, I think there's a lot. There's many of them that are, and we note that in the report that there's a lot of good organizations out there doing extremely important and good work. And there's a very good, you know, structure in place that needs to be tweaked and needs to be sort of refocused at times. It's not necessarily in every aspect a complete rebuild of the structure of the system and different groups that are working on this. It's just a re-emphasis in certain aspects on what they're doing and how they're doing it. And for instance, we talk about the need for, you know, refocusing how we talk about food and food insecurity and changing vocabulary and language around this to get this to be a more public-facing issue so people understand it better, to get it out there to the public more. But also when we think about it in different terms, we then create different policies, we put different policies in place and can use this as a tool for other things as well. So I think there's that aspect of it.
Thank you. That's really informative regarding just how unique each different situation for food security could be. Would you have any last thoughts or recommendations that we weren't able to touch upon yet?
Yeah, I just think, you know, this report and doing the meetings we had on this, bringing in specialists and generalists, practitioners, academics, think tank folks, government folks, to talk about this issue, just really put it in stark terms how big of an issue this is, and it's not going away. And we really don't have the correct things overall in place to combat this and push back against growing hunger. And it really needs to be front and center. And it's so intertwined to many different things that we talked about today with global health and pandemics and climate change and conflict. And it really gets at a lot of different things that are major issues in the world today. And I think, you know, if people are confident that they can, you know, feed their families and get the nutrition they need. And that's another big aspect of this too, is we need to, you know, look at this through a nutritional lens, not necessarily a caloric lens moving forward. That's going to go a long way towards getting people the right types of food to eat, not just necessarily calories. And that goes to that notion I mentioned of sort of refocusing this and looking at things in a different way and new vocabulary and things like that. But I think just the intertwined nature of this and just how big of an issue this is for all countries, not just developing or poor nations, but even countries in the West and the United States in particular. So, you know, I think it's something that people should be aware of, and we really need to do a lot more to fix the system. Because it's, you know, the challenges to food security are just going to grow in the coming decades. They're not going to go away on their own. We know that we produce enough food to feed the world. It's just a matter of getting that food to people and making sure that there's resiliency in the supply chains that get food to people and things of that nature. So it's a daunting challenge, but something I think with the right focus, I think we can. Have positive success in the future.
This was 37th and the World. Thank you to Kelly McFarland. Please be sure to subscribe and leave a comment rating whichever streaming platform you use. To read this interview and other insightful interviews and articles, please check out jujia.georgetown.edu. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.